Welcome. You're listening to the second episode of Seattle Veterans for Peace. We're a monthly broadcast keeping you up to date on current and local issues applicable to the ongoing struggle against militarism and war. I'm Jessica Davis, and I'm here with Michael McPherson and Mike Diedrich. We're all military veterans and members of VFP Chapter 92. Today we want to discuss and relay information about VFP, our history as an organization and what we do, as well as share our personal experiences about the journey from war to peace. We'll also be relaying some information about upcoming events that we're involved in. Veterans for Peace is a global organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace by using our experiences and lifting our voices. We inform the public of the true causes of war and the enormous costs of war, with an obligation to heal the wounds of war. Our network is comprised of over 140 chapters worldwide, whose work includes educating the public, advocating for a dismantling of the war economy, providing services that assist veterans and victims of war, and most significantly, working to end all wars. Veterans for Peace has three integrated program areas that work together to forward our grand mission to abolish war. It is the intent of Veterans for Peace to educate the public about the full costs of war, to be a leading example of resisting militarism through efforts to end current wars and work to change U.S. foreign policy from war to diplomacy, and to heal the wounds of wars and build a just and peaceful society. These three program areas with our legislative work are a foundation to forward the mission of Veterans for Peace. Our statement of purpose is that we, as military veterans, do hereby affirm our greater responsibility to serve the cause of world peace. To this end, we will work with others both nationally and internationally to 1, increase public awareness of the causes and costs of war, to 2, restrain our governments from intervening overtly and covertly in the internal affairs of other nations, to 3, end the arms race and to reduce and eventually eliminate nuclear weapons, 4, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and 5, to abolish war as an instrument of national policy. To achieve these goals, members of Vets for Peace pledges to use nonviolent means and to maintain an organization that is both democratic and open, with the understanding that all members are trusted to act in the best interests of the group for the larger purpose of world peace. A little bit about our national history is Veterans for Peace was founded in 1985 by 10 U.S. veterans in response to the global nuclear arms race and U.S. military interventions in Central America. The organization rapidly grew more than 8,000 members in the buildup to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Our veteran membership includes 70 years of service spanning World War II to the current era. In the last 30 years, VFP has led or participated in over 60 peace delegations to Latin America, Vietnam, Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. We have collaborated with dozens of organizations and sponsored thousands of activities promoting peace in this country. And now I'm going to pass it over to Mike, who's been with our local chapter here in Seattle since the beginning, and he's going to tell you a little bit about that.
Hi, I'm Mike Diedrich. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I've been a chapter member since its beginning, which was in 2003. I served as its first interim chapter president. And since that time, Veterans for Peace has been involved in quite a few activities, including counter-recruiting in the schools, and that is going into the schools and providing some alternative points of view about militarism and war, something that these students won't get from military recruiters. We have an annual presentation at the Hiroshima and Nagasaki thing in August at Green Lake, where we have a table and talk about the dangers of nuclear weapons. We also partner up with other anti-nuclear organizations like Ground Zero and over in the peninsula. We participate also at various rallies and protests, including our weekly rally downtown, which is at the federal courthouse, the annual Martin Luther King Day parade here in Seattle, and also for the this year will be the 13th year that we've participated in the Auburn Veterans Day Parade. We call it the Armistice Day Parade. Billed itself as the largest Veterans Day so-called parade west of the Mississippi. There are over 200 entrants, and we're the only anti-war veteran organization there. We've commemorated Armistice Day by ringing the bells at particularly St. James Cathedral here in Seattle, and also doing some Armistice Day programs.
So I joined the Navy as an active duty service member in 2001. I was 17 years old, and I signed up out of Texas. I signed up out of Houston. And when I first joined, you know, I of course, like a lot of people, just wanted to go to college, wanted to get on a better track than I was on in Texas, growing up pretty poor. And the military was heavily recruiting at the time, so it just seemed like a good option. It seemed like a good way to get out of where I was and to move on. So I joined sort of unknowing where I was going. I was in boot camp in Great Lakes in the middle of winter. I did really well in the very beginning. And I guess I was in probably about 9 months before 9/11 happened. And then that was just a big turning point for me, where I just started to really wake up to like what the military was and what we were doing. And so I found myself on this ship that's responding to 9/11, and you know, everything's just really intense. And at the time, I couldn't really realize the profundity of what was happening, but it was not, it wasn't our usual deployments. We weren't scheduled to go out to sea. It was all just very sudden. And to me, it was really shady at the time even, but it took me a long time to really realize what had happened. But so right away I'm experiencing 9/11, and then we're just deployed the whole time. And I probably spent about 3 years on the ship deployed out to sea. We're invading different countries, we're bombing places, lots of stuff's going down. I'm a photographer and I'm working in intel, so I'm seeing a lot of things. And quickly just realizing I have moral issues with what we're doing, and I'm not really agreeing with the mission, and really agreeing with a lot of the leadership, and just seeing a lot of people not doing very well mentally or even physically. And I don't know, the next thing you know, we're bombing Fallujah. And for me, that was kind of a breaking point where I just really got sick. I got sick and I lost my mind, and I watched a lot of people around me do the same thing. And when I came back from that deployment, I was never the same. And I had a really hard time staying in the military even. I was in a lot of trouble, just struggling with addiction and struggling with myself, and not really knowing what to do about it. But I did finish my time, and I got out, and I thought that that would be it and I'd move on. But I wasn't well, so I ended up in treatment for a really long time, and I was a lot worse than I thought I would be. I was just pretty much unemployable. I couldn't keep a job. I had a really hard time with a lot of things, and eventually I figured out that it was PTSD from going to therapy and seeing different doctors and everything. And I thankfully got myself on disability, but just really started reflecting on my military service and the impact that the military has on the culture in our country, and just a lot of different things, and really regretting regretting using my youth in that way, or and also just feeling really taken advantage of by the country and our government, and continuing to see a lot of people be sick that I served with, and other friends still coming and going from the wars. And I just knew that there was something else to be done. And watching the effort that went towards war, I realized that we could make an effort towards peace that's like actually towards peace. And so I started doing more activism, and I realized that that was a big part of healing for me. So I eventually started bumping into Veterans for Peace in different places and realized that we had a lot of the same things in common, and meeting other veterans and just realizing that I wasn't alone, that I wasn't the only person that felt the way that I did, and that a lot of other people were saying the same things that I was, and I'm not crazy, and that, war is bad and we need to do something about it, and we need to figure out a more mature way of dealing with things and get the power out of the corrupt people's hands, the crazy people. So that's kind of my little journey in a nutshell.
Okay. Well, I'm Michael McPherson. I'm recently moved here to the Seattle area. I've been here less than a year. I'm excited to be here and work with the local chapter. I served in the United States Army. I went into the military between my junior and senior year of high school, actually. I went to basic training when I was 17 years old. Went with the buddy system, another buddy of mine. I'm from Fayetteville, North Carolina, where Fort Bragg's located. So I grew up around the military most of my life. We moved to Virginia, but we moved near Fort Lee, so I still was around the military. Then we moved back to North Carolina. So joining the military was kind of more of a career choice, I guess, because that's all you see around you. And you see families doing well, as far as you can tell from the outside. You see people taking care of their families. Your friends get out of high school and they come back driving nice cars. So you want to do that too. So it was a lot of positive reasons. Seeing the soldiers being really professional, that makes you want to join the military. And of course, and that's firsthand, most people don't get to see that kind of thing. Then on top of that, you got all that stuff that they teach everybody when you go to the movies and John Wayne and all that kind of stuff. So it's almost impossible for most people who grew up in Fayetteville not to at least look closely at the military. So I was one of the ones that chose it. I was in the reserve. I went to college and became an officer. I chose combat arms. I chose field artillery. I chose it for two reasons, basically. One is because I felt like, well, I guess three reasons. One is because if I was going to be in the military, I felt like I needed to be in combat arms, or why be in the military? Not that I wanted to kill anybody. It's just that it's what the military is for, fighting. So if I was going to be in it, I wanted to be part of that. The other thing is I'm not a big guy. I'm a small guy, and I didn't want to carry a heavy rucksack that weighs as much as me. So that's why I decided not to go into the infantry. And I didn't want to be in a tank and die in a tank. Couldn't see the rounds coming at me. So that's why I didn't become a tanker. So that's why I picked field artillery. I participated in what people call the first Gulf War. But from my perspective, this is the same war that we're in today. 1991 was just the first ground campaign, air campaign of the war we're in now. And just some perspective, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States embarked on global expansion of its power. And that was the first effort at that. Fortunately for me, I was in country for 7 months. I didn't have any big traumatic experiences, small things comparative to what many of my veteran friends and certainly victims of war in these countries have gone through. So I'm not gonna go through any of those stories. But what turned me away from thinking war was something that we needed to do, because I used to think it was a necessary evil. I was never really all fired up about war or thinking war was good. I always thought it was bad. And I never saw people, in quotes, called our enemies as less than human. I was brought up as a Christian, and I still hold those tenets. And the way I was brought up is that we're all sisters and brothers across the world. So, but I just thought sometimes you have to go to war to stop evildoers. But since then, I've come to realize that war is more of a choice. than it is necessary evil. I do realize that us as humans haven't really figured out how to live together yet, so we're on that path to do that, and I believe Veterans for Peace is part of that. But I know this country specifically makes choices about going to war. We're an empire, we're the most powerful nation in the world. We do not have to go to war as much as we do. And what's really started me looking at that is one day in September, it was the summer of 2001, so it was before September 11. I was working for an organization called the National Conference for Community and Justice. It was formerly known as the National Conference of Christians and Jews. And I was going to a training at the Anti-Defamation League in New York City. And I saw someone holding up a sign that talked about the 500,000 children that had been killed as a result of U.S. sanctions in Iraq. And having been part of that war, it just hit me in the chest that I hold some responsibility for those 500,000 deaths. So that really made me start to think about, you know, my role in U.S. foreign policy. I never trusted the government, but I was thinking more about it at home. As a black person, my ancestors would be enslaved. It'd be kind of silly for me to take what the government says at face value. You always got to look at what they're saying, but I never really looked at the foreign policy aspect to the degree that that sign made me look at it. So I started to look into trying to find a home in the peace movement, and I didn't really feel like the organizations that I looked at were someplace I wanted to put most of my effort. But fortunately, I was able to find Veterans for Peace. I met David Klein, who was the president at the time. He was an awesome person. He's no longer with us now. He's a Vietnam veteran, combat veteran, decorated veteran. And he showed me how to, I never used my veteran identity per se to work for a peace or to be even be an activist, but he was able to lay out for me through what he did. He was an example of how I could do that, and I was able to find VFP. Also, Military Family Speak Out is another organization that I think was very important to me during the early years of this Afghanistan-Iraq war. Because my son also had decided to go into the military. So that was a place that I could find other parents who were concerned. And one last thing I have to say is that when I was at war, I had no idea what my mother was going through. But my son going to war gave me a whole different perspective. Sometimes I would just break down and start crying for no apparent reason other than thinking about what might happen to my son. There are also times when someone's child, you hear in the news a child had been killed and you wonder if it's yours. And then when you find out it's not, you're really happy. But then you think about, but it was somebody's child. All of a sudden you start to feel guilty. So this is what military families and service members go through that's really not talked about.
Thank you, Michael. I'm Mike Dieter, as I mentioned earlier, and my path to the military was through the draft. I was drafted in 1966. Prior to that time, I had been in school for several years and had flunked out twice from the University of Washington, and that's why I lost my draft deferment. So I was drafted. I did not want to go into the military. By that time, I was over 21, and sort of a little different story from my co-presenters here. By the time I went in the service at 21, I was kind of an old guy, an old person compared to my presenters here, but also to a lot of the people that I served in the military with who were 18, 19 years old. I got out of the service when I was in Vietnam. I was 23. But I came to the military because I was drafted. I subsequently enlisted to get a little, a little better deal in the military, going into military intelligence, thinking it would be a better deal. They sent me to military intelligence school, but then, which was for like a 6 month course, and then was actually an intelligence analyst. And then when I finished that course, it says, okay, We gave you the school that you signed up for. Now we're going to make you an interrogator. So four-week course later, I was an interrogator, and that was changed to my primary MOS. So that's what I did for a year. From intelligence school, Fort Holabird, Maryland, I went to Biggsfield, Fort Bliss, Texas, near El Paso, and spent 6 months for language training. And then from there, directly to Vietnam, where I spent 361 days as an interrogator with the 519th MI Battalion, Company A. My epiphany or conversion to war or experience with war was something I didn't really realize at the time and turned me into an anti-war veteran, ultimately, was during the Tet Offensive during 1968. And where we were just outside of Saigon, there was a lot of fighting, and we were next to a village, a refugee village, where there was some fighting and there were some infiltrators. But the American and the Arvin military, their way of fighting is that the way we've always fought wars, and that's to blow everything up. And if civilians are in a way, that's too bad. For us that were there, right next to these people, some of them we knew. They were villagers. They ran our pop stores. They ran the bars and that sort of thing. Some of these people were people we knew. So when they got killed, some of them brought their dead and wounded to our compound because we were all locked down. And the biggest problem with that for me was the children who were killed. And it's really was an intimate, direct sort of involvement with the war. I saw these guys flying the F-100s and the helicopters and the Thunderbolts and that sort of thing. I said, and the door gunners and the choppers. And I realized, it's only a flip of the coin that I could have been doing that. It wasn't something that they weren't doing anything unusual, that probably I was lucky enough not to be able to do that direct killing. After the war, I got out and was lucky to get out with an honorable discharge, quite frankly, because I didn't like the military and had some problem with the authority. I returned to the United States and was angry and depressed about what I had seen. I didn't really sort of put it all together until actually 1971. We invaded Cambodia, and I said, I couldn't believe we'd be doing something like this. I'd gotten out in late 1968, so I'd spent the better part of a year and a half watching television and watching the war on television, which wasn't really good for me particularly, but I joined at that point local chapter of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and ultimately serving as regional coordinator, and was active in the anti-war movement. And being an anti-war veteran in the anti-war movement was really quite a liberating experience in a lot of ways, but mostly it was because the anti-war civilians welcomed with open arms these me and the other veterans who were in the organizations that were opposed to the war. I've been active ever since then, including coming full circle to where I am now and starting in 2003 as a member of Veterans for Peace. And like some of my other members here have said, it actually provided a way to deal with my experience in the war and also therapy for me, and it helped deal with my PTSD, quite frankly. When I first got out of the service, I spent about 7 years drinking. And I was able to actually meet my future wife and also quit drinking and get some therapy for my PTSD. But being a member of a veterans anti-war group has been an ongoing sort of positive influence in my life. So it being Christmas, one of the things that we wanted to talk about this time was some history of the Christmas truce, which happened in the First World War, in the beginning years of the First World War in 1914. And on the Western Front, that is between the forces, the German and the British forces, there was a lull in the fighting, and there had been tens of thousands of people killed up to that point already. But a group of soldiers on both sides almost spontaneously decided to stop shooting, as in not doing anything aggressive about it, They came out of their trenches and sang songs and exchanged some gifts. It was a brief respite, but a good example of and one of the first examples, really, in the modern age of soldiers opposing war by not fighting. And that was in the middle of a war. The subsequent reprisals and almost hysteria by the military commands on both sides was swift. The French in particular, who weren't involved in this particular thing, but their French soldiers who actually were charged with mutiny for refusing to fight. Several hundred were actually shot and court-martialed and shot. Several thousand were actually court-martialed. They estimate that among the French army, almost 40% of the French army was that what they call infected with these mutineers. I think that's an important example of not a very well-known example of active duty soldiers in the middle of a war standing up and saying no, however briefly. There's been a lot of I don't know if every veteran for every war since then has been aware of that example, but also many veterans have opposed the war in Iraq, in Vietnam, and Afghanistan.
I think that's a great point, yeah, because a lot of people have in their minds that war is a lot like a movie where there's these good guys and these bad guys and everybody's, you know, real cool and hitting their target and got some moves or whatever, but it's not really like that. Like, a lot of people are hiding or... I've heard of people standing up in the middle of it and stuff too.
Yeah. One of the things that there's a lot of things that strike me about the Christmas truce. Some parts of the story where they started playing soccer together, or how I guess the Germans were singing, where they both were singing on both sides, and I read something that said some of the Germans were the ones that got up and started walking towards the Brits, yeah, and the Brits were like, "Is this some kind of trick?" But they saw that they weren't armed, so yeah, they came out of the trenches too and went and shook hands and talked to each other. They used it as an opportunity to get dead bodies, their comrades, yeah, that were strewn across the battlefield. And one of the things, I guess the biggest thing out of all that, because clearly the people didn't want to fight each other, and just as you were saying, Aurora, you know, they put it out there like it's good guys and bad guys, and we got to kill these people, mm-hmm, you know, in the movies. But in real life, more times than not, I believe that people don't have any idea who they're fighting or why they're fighting them clearly, you know. So these two people didn't want to fight each other. This was at the beginning of the war. Some people call it the first armistice, right? And as you were saying, Mike, it was a kind of like a virus in a way, a virus of peace, in that it wanted to spread, but the higher ups were like, no, we're not going to have this. Mm-hmm. And they prosecuted people, and they had to do that over at least 1 or 2 years, because it almost, mm-hmm, started to come back again. Mm-hmm. So it strikes me how much humans really don't want to fight each other and kill each other, and how it takes some kind of prodding. You know, it takes some kind
abuse.
Of
abuse.
Yes, and BS, want to say, propaganda, to make us believe things about each other in order for us to kill each other. And I'm just to connect that to something going on today with the Afghan war papers that came out from the Washington Post, and how commanders, people in charge now, right, didn't know exactly why. What they were doing in Afghanistan and why we're fighting. Now, these are the top generals.
I'm not surprised.
Saying this, right? But that's crazy.
It is crazy.
Right? And so if the top general doesn't have any idea why he is there, then you know good and damn well.
Yeah. These are people who had been to war colleges. Right. They're probably most, a lot of them have degrees, you know,
yes,
they're a master's degree, a lot of them. And that they don't know what they're talking about or doing is nothing more than amazing, really.
Right. Yeah. So the average soldier couldn't possibly.
Right. I always say that, like, it's always the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, but really, I was at the very bottom of the ranks, but I worked in intel, and I feel like we found out about more stuff than the people that were in charge of us because of hearsay and gossip and that sort of thing. But you really get to see how... high-ranking people are shielded from a lot of information because people are afraid of getting in trouble, or they don't want to know. They don't want the boss to know about whatever. And
that's interesting to say that, because if you read, if the audience, if you get a chance, please read at least some of the reports. But it talked about that, how people felt pressured to change numbers and to not to tell the truth. You know, like, because if you tell, if you give bad news, you're going to get in trouble for it. So it's a similar, it's not exactly the same thing.
And when it comes out that there was actually what they call war crimes, or people, soldiers actually shooting civilians, what they call collateral damage, it's the lower ranking, usually the lower ranking enlisted, the specialists and sergeants and petty officers, and maybe in a lieutenant or captain, but they're always the ones that are blamed, pointed the fingers at, and not the generals who got us there in the first place, who didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
It definitely speaks to the psychology that happens with people that are serving for a long time, that are involved in a lot of wars, that see a lot of just gory things. I think there's a desensitization, and that they are suffering from PTSD, and that they are having issues, but it seems as though whoever's good at war is probably the sickest. And then they're the ones that stick around and become the highest ranking. And I saw a lot of that in the Navy, just a lot of people that were clearly displaying psychosis, and admirals, captains, just people that were very, very out of it, and probably on lots of different medications and just not really fit for duty. And and that would become a rumor, you know, everybody on the ship's talking about, you know, this admiral, you know, and he's actually a really nice guy and everybody really likes him, but he's just crazy and walks onto the flight deck with no gear and just different stuff like that, little things, but all the time. And you're like, this is what's going on with these people. Like, and they're in charge.
Well, they're sort of, you know, these days they're kind of, I mean, if you're talking about, say, the special operations troops, the SEALs, Rangers, and special forces, those guys that have been in and been like a half a dozen or a dozen tours overseas, they're kind of like throwaways because they're not really able to integrate into civilian life. The only thing they know is killing people or helping people kill each other. And so they stay in the military until they can't anymore, until they get, you know, discharged for one reason or another. One of the reasons that they stay in and don't get any help is because military's got this culture of, you know, you just suck it up, be a man.
You know? In a way, it's almost a cult. You know, it's like it is a whole different universe. And if you stay there, you're going to be okay or something. But once you come out into the civilian world, the same things aren't going to apply anymore. And that's definitely, even after just serving, I served for 5 years and I felt that coming out. I wanted to get out really bad, but I was still really afraid. And the transition into civilian life was terrifying. It was very tempting to, it wasn't really an option for me to stay, but it was just terrifying to get out, even though I wanted to get out and they wanted me out, and I was definitely going to get out, but I had a harder time than I thought I would.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that military does, and it affected me less because I was an older guy when I went in and a little bit more formed, is that the military's got this way of looking at civilians, and they sort of sneer at you, the civilians, and us versus them.
Yeah.
We know what we're doing. We're the heroes. We're doing our duty and that sort of thing, and civilians don't know what there's some truth to that, though.
There's some truth. Civilians know even less than what we know, which is not much.
Yeah.
The sheep.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I just want to say to our audience, we were talking briefly about the Afghan war. Please call your congressperson and demand that we bring all the troops home, and at a minimum that there's an investigation as to what is going on when it comes to Afghanistan. And to be honest with you, although that the report wasn't about Iraq, there's no difference between what we're doing there in Afghanistan. We don't know what we're doing in Iraq, just like we don't know what the hell we're doing in Afghanistan. So call for that as well. Just want to give you all something to do to make a difference. I know you might feel like whatever you do is not going to change anything, but the truth is it will. And what you're doing is you're going to be helping to save lives in Afghanistan and Iraq and soldiers who are still dying in these wars.
You know, as a concrete example of what they don't know what they're doing was, I was at a conference with some of the people that I served with in military intelligence people. And one of the things that happened was this lieutenant colonel who had just brought the 519th MI battalion back from Iraq. And this was so 4 or 5 years ago. And he did a teleconference with the people who were sitting with us. And he thanked us all for being here, was that sort of thing. And then one of the guys I knew who was an interrogator, and he said, sir, he says, what sort of language capability did you have while I was in Iraq as the military intelligence unit in the Army? This is the unit, 519th MI. And he says, oh, we didn't have time to develop that capability. Wow. So whatever intelligence they had, which is usually corrupted anyway, they didn't have any American language specialists in Iraq.
That's
in
crazy.
Intelligence,
right.
Which is, you could hear a pin drop when he went and said that, and some of us, but it was like just amazing. And it's, you know, he seemed to, well, we just didn't make that. This is a, you know, that's just the way it was.
Yeah.
Well, how could they possibly know what the hell they were doing without that sort of basic sort of asset?
Right.
I feel like I observed this a lot, that there's this really chaotic element going on, that people are addicted is what all I could say is, mm-hmm. that there's this addiction to power that can't be fulfilled. Like you can go for power and money forever. And I definitely feel like that a lot of the war is just driven by this, the same madness that a heroin addict would have, the same madness that someone who's, you know, on crack or amphetamines. I think it's no different, except that they're not going to have the physical repercussions of a drug addiction. And I think that people get dug in these holes where they're lying and they're just doing all this stuff and they have no idea what's going on, but they can't perceive what's going on anymore either. They're right. just dug in and you know, one thing's happening and they're covering up another thing and they can't keep it straight and, you know.
Right.
Well, I totally agree. And moving on a little bit to two other things we really wanted to talk about briefly. One of them is Armistice Day. And many of you might not know what Armistice Day is, but that was the end of World War One. And one of the reasons you don't know what Armistice Day is because eventually Armistice Day in the United States was turned into Veterans Day. Now, originally Armistice Day was, of course, to commemorate the end of the war, but it was also a day to think about peace. We wanted to remember those who had died in the war, in World War One, but we also wanted to celebrate the ending of the war and to think about peace because many people, by the time the war ended, and even before, because as I said, some people called that Christmas truce the first armistice, many people had come to the conclusion that war just doesn't work. And by the time of the end of that war, of the millions of people who had died, especially in Europe, people had come to that conclusion. And they really wanted to work towards a time where we would not have any wars at all. That's one of the reasons we have one of the things that came out of that war was the League of Nations, because people were really serious about the idea of we don't have to do this anymore. But when you have people who are trying to be idealistic, and to be honest with you, I don't even see it as idealism anymore. I see it as an imperative,
mm-hmm.
because if we don't do this, we're going to destroy ourselves one way or another. So who's being idealistic? I'm just talking about what
we
need
to do. It's like really being realistic, but it is kind of crazy that it's considered so far out or whatever,
right.
And it's just like, why, you know?
Right.
Like, we can build these, like, go look at an aircraft carrier, you know, and to me that's like this marvelous thing that we've built, this, you know, and it's amazing to think how many people have to come together
right.
to build something like that and then to operate it, and it's like all we have to do is change the intention or change the point of things, and
right.
to me, I know that I'm simplifying it, but
not really, because with climate change, we are really going to have to change the mm-hmm. point of why we do a lot of things. And the aircraft carrier could be a perfect example of a vehicle to use to save people, for example, exactly. or something like that. So
even nuclear power itself doesn't have to be used for bombs.
So when you have people who are thinking idealistically or wanting to go in a positive direction, you still have people who want to go in a negative direction.
Mm-hmm.
So in my mind, I think part of the reason that people wanted to see us not celebrate Armistice Day in the way that it was intended to think about peace is because there are people who believe that war is the only way we can solve problems. And some of them, it's not even a matter of if they believe it is or not. They just want to make money off of it,
mm-hmm.
right? And others just want to have power. So those people got together, and I'm not trying to say it was a conspiracy per se, but in their own individual ways and working with people for whatever different reasons, tried to shift the narrative to a place where we're celebrating war, where we're celebrating the veteran and what the veteran has done at war, which is a way to more militarize our society and propagandize us to thinking that we have to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
So when September 11 happened, for example, I knew, or I felt very strongly, our nation was going to go to war, not because I felt like we had to go to war, but because I know the mentality of people and thinking that now we've got to go and avenge what has happened, instead of maybe there being an investigation
mm-hmm.
and trying to figure out exactly what happened and maybe work with the Afghan government to hold those people accountable. You know, maybe we need to do some of that first.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if that doesn't work, well, I don't know. Maybe we do have to go to war, but we didn't do that. We jumped right into war. So I just wanted to bring up that about Armistice Day as it relates to the Christmas truce.
Right. Well, the impetus to go to war is sort of built in with the militarism. We've got this gigantic military and military funding, and say, well, what do we have these people for if not to go and shoot somebody? And that is the way this country has operated for actually quite a long time. And there doesn't seem to be any sort of alternative point of view that, as you say, you know, maybe we should investigate. And well, in the case of Iraq, there are actually people who said, wait a minute, let's not do this. Scott Ritter was among other mm-hmm. people who said, "This all this information about the weapons of mass destruction is all bogus," as it turned out to be. And people went over there and died for actually a phony lie. The impetus to do these things is based because we do have a military, and our only sort of response and foreign policy way seems to be with military force.
That's right. Because if I go to Home Depot or Lowe's and buy a bunch of hand tools and saws and stuff, when I get home, I'm looking for stuff to use that on, man. I just bought this saw. I got to see what I can use it on. And that's
right.
That's real. That's not,
you know,
you don't buy things to have it just hanging around and look at it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And the other part of this, of course, is the defense industry.
Yes.
And they aid and abet the military contractors with weapon systems, that sort of thing, tell Congress and of course the military is involved, the senior military says, well, of course we need that. We need to. And what does this country need? We've got a dozen standing military divisions, the Marine Corps and the Army alone, to say nothing of the rest of the thing. What do we need 150,000 men standing army? It's the military.
And the Navy is massive.
Right. The Navy is massive. It's
two navies.
Yeah.
We have one in the Pacific Ocean, and we have one in the Atlantic Ocean.
And Mediterranean.
I mean,
yeah.
And in the Indian. We've got like 6 fleets, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely saw that clearly from the Navy ship, is that we just dominate the whole world and intimidate and just terrorize, and people are afraid of us. And they are also hopeful for us, which is really sad, but you definitely feel that double, you know, conundrum going on where people think we're there to help them, but we're not.
Well, the Navy thing is they say about, well, if we ever get finished with Iraq and Afghanistan, we're going to pivot to the Pacific and confront the Chinese, who have now just built their second aircraft carrier. But the Chinese, for all the size of their military, has never been historically an imperialist power. They've got a large military, but they basically don't rattle swords, and they haven't, it wasn't the Chinese who invaded other countries in Southeast, was the Japanese and the Americans.
Yeah. So, I would imagine it's always a response to us, and that's the escalation of war, and you can see it through the creation of weapons. You know, we start out with really basic weapons, and now we have these really advanced weapons, and it's like this just evolution that's going on that's completely out of control, but right. It just takes over.
And our guerrilla wars, the advanced weapons, the night vision capability, the all-weather capability for aircraft in Iraq, and it's true of Afghanistan. Basically, we're fighting people with AK-47s and handheld rocket launchers.
That we
and
sold to them.
They're poppy farmers and tomato farmers. Right. That's what these people do.
Right.
And we're not winning. We never win in Iraq, and we're not winning in Afghanistan.
And a good correlation to bring up with the poppy is that we invaded Afghanistan, which is where all this opium is coming from, and we're currently in an epidemic with opium. Mm-hmm. That's killing more. They just did some new statistics. It's killing more than anybody. Is more than car crashes, more than cancer, is this opium epidemic. And it correlates exactly to when we invaded Afghanistan. And then the other thing is the veterans wear this poppy. And I know that this isn't intentional, but it's this sort of subliminal or Freudian slip that goes on with people. And this, you know, it's like we're... This is right in front of our face, but we can't see it.
Right. Well, there's so many people dying that is lowering the life expectancy rate in the United States.
Yeah. Right. They're
so
saying
it's really bad.
I'm 37 years old, and the people in my generation are going to hit. And it's already happening because I have a lot of friends in my 40s that do have all kinds of mysterious diseases, and we're the first generation that grew up just completely exposed to chemicals and drugs and. Just at such a rate that there's these predictions that when I'm in my 50s, essentially all my friends are going to be dying.
Right.
Because
wow. Well, one other topic that we want to talk about briefly is the Kellogg-Briand Pact. And this is an international agreement, a peacekeeping agreement that was signed by many, many nations in 1928. And the reason that I thought it might be important for us to talk about this briefly is because, again, coming out of World War I, most of the world saw that war doesn't work. So these nations got together, including the United States, Germany, France. So the major nations, not small nations who weren't fighting each other, but major nations got together and decided that we needed to have an agreement with each other that we will not fight each other any longer. Now, clearly, that agreement didn't work out because we had World War II. And we should probably have another show to talk about the different forces that actually led up to World War II. But I think the reason that I find the Kellogg-Briand Pact to be important is because there's this idea out there that everyone always thought that war is the way to solve problems, and that there was never a time when major powers were looking for an alternative to war. And not that long ago, because it was in the shadow of one of the worst conflicts, if not the worst conflict the world has ever seen. You know, right after something happens to you and it's a lesson learned and it's one of those things you want to remember, but over time you forget. I think that's what has happened to us now. It's been over 100 years and we seem to have forgotten what a war like that really is like. And the toll, the human toll, the financial toll, just what it does to people. And I'm really afraid that we're heading in the direction of another great power confrontation. Because as you said, Mike, supposedly after whatever happens in the Middle East is done, the war planners are talking about shifting, pivoting
to
China.
Escalate.
Right. And, go ahead.
Just continues to escalate.
Yes.
Right. Until we're all pointing nukes. I mean, we are already pointing nukes at each other, but until somebody's launching them, that's... That's the fear, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, the Kellogg-Briand Pact is actually still in force. The United States, even the United States, has not repudiated its signing of it, and it's actually a matter of still an agreement that is still in force, even that it's 80, 90 years old. And I think actually one of the reasons that we had a United Nations in after World War II was because of this sort of past history of cooperation about doing something about war and peace. and mentioned nuclear weapons, about 140 nations have signed this agreement in the United Nations for the abolition of nuclear weapons. It's the United States has not signed it, but it's a standing United Nations resolution on the abolition of nuclear weapons and how to do that. And I think that that's a positive step. Michael mentioned in talking to your congressional, you know, we still in this state, we've got a heavy, heavy nuclear weapons presence with our Bangor Trident subs. And getting our House representatives and also state or federal senators to support this treaty, urge the United States to support it, is an important sort of step. And it does make a difference if you call or write these people and tell them that you support this treaty and urge the United States to sign it. It does make a difference. The only way you can do it, I mean, unless you believe, the Mao Zedong, change comes out of a barrel of a gun, which I don't and none of us do, then you're stuck with a legislative process and you have to elect sane and progressive people to be your federal and state representatives.
Right. And sometimes you're going to have to take action. You have to get out on the street. Got to let people know that I'm not going anywhere until you end this. We might have to go on some kind of strikes. There's things that we're going to have to do because it does take power to change things. But the power should not be that out of the barrel of a gun, as you say.
Right.
It can take people power because they can't do anything unless we let them. You know, they can't make us do stuff if we all are together.
Exactly.
You know?
And that's like the Christmas truce makes me feel that hope or that that idea that there's so many of us and that an idea can really ripple out through people, and especially when it's the truth and especially when it's like the right thing to do. And I think that it's more powerful than people think, and that when you can get your head out of the space of we're doomed and I'm afraid, you kind of start seeing, maybe not. Like, maybe we have a choice. Maybe we can change things. Maybe I can make a difference. And maybe that will inspire the people around me to make a difference. And that's a big deal, when everybody gets on the same page.
That's right. That's right.
I just want to mention a few people. I mean, some are more well-known than others. But Aaron Watata, who is a local captain who said that he would not go to Iraq. He was given a less than honorable or a other than honorable discharge. He said he would actually go to fight in Afghanistan, but Iraq was an illegal war. He wasn't going to fight it. You know, and earlier that, during Vietnam, the Presidio Stockade Rebellion, one of our members was Randy Rowland was a member of that group of people who protested the treatment they were getting and was court-martialed and charged with mutiny, like the soldiers in First World War were charged with. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, Randy wasn't shot or executed. But there's a lot of other people who have stood up. Jeff Patterson, some people in IVAW who actually participated in the
Winter Soldier
investigation, one of which we had here, and talked about their participation in war. So there's a lot of veterans, and I think that one of the things that encourages me to being a member of Veterans for Peace is that I know that being a veteran and being an anti-war veteran and having a voice is something that people respect and honor, and it's I encourage other veterans to have this sort of self-awareness, as you talk about, Michael, and that what you do is important and it actually has an impact. As the expression of it in the fighting game of boxing says, we punch a lot higher than our weight class.
That's true. Well, thank you for being with us today. This is our second episode, right?
Yeah.
Of our podcast. Our radio show.
It'll be a podcast, hopefully.
The music you heard at the beginning of the show and will close us out is Untouchable from the Passion Hi-Fi. You can find him at passionhi-fi.com. We are looking for some music right?
Yeah.
So we're going to have some new music for you.
And if you have any good music you want to suggest, maybe we can have some people send stuff in if you want.
Yeah, and make sure it's peaceful. It needs to be peaceful music.
and not copyrighted.
That's right.
Or
right.
If you're a famous musician and you want us to use your music, you can totally hit us up.
Yes. So I guess we should say Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays. Just spend
Winter solstice.
Happy Hanukkah.
Whatever it is you celebrate, celebrate.
Right. Celebrate it and pray and wish and put out positive meditations for peace.
And visualize everybody in the military having like a Christmas truce. Everybody laying down their arms and waking up.
Okay, roger that. Over.